Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. McLean County will be opening a nearly $40 million jail expansion in a few weeks. It will go down as one of the largest projects the county has undergone during County Administrator Bill Wasson's third of a century of service to McLean County. He speaks with GLT's Eric Stock about the jail addition, the new county budget, and what's next for McLean County with an overhauled governing board.
Project is going very well for a project that is as encompassing as it is. We've especially with the addition to the Law and Justice Center, the new facility, have met with very few surprises, and we are generally on track and on schedule to occupy that section. And some of that depends upon how the renovation work, which has already begun, goes in the current Law and Justice Center main facility. And so we are happy with the progress. The real benefit to the new facility is our ability to classify detainees and to house them in separate areas depending upon, for instance, any special needs, including a mental illness, behavioral illness. And we have one specific special needs pod for both men and for women in the new facility. It gives us the ability to segregate populations when needed, and allow individuals to be treated, and with the goal of returning them ultimately through to the general population. But our anticipation is that with sub-day rooms and special needs pods, that we'll be able to progress an individual over time and through treatment back to the general population. So that's our goal, is to help people get well if they need health treatment, and get them back to a point where they can function in the general population.
If you could address the beds themselves for the mentally ill inmates, how are they different, and how is it supposed to be a more conducive toward their treatment?
The special needs pod has different finishes on the doors, on the walls. It is intended to provide a softer, less a less commercial type environment, and hopefully an environment that will not distract or detract from individuals' treatment that they receive within the unit. There are special wall coverings that will go on the walls that portray forest scenes in a kind of pixelated manner, and the doors have a wood grain finish to them. So and the furniture is different. It is less like the general population pods, which are just steel framework within the detainee rooms that create a bed. There is actual furniture, seats, chairs, a bed that are in the special needs unit. So again, attempting to normalize the environment that they're in.
All under budget?
We're within budget right now, and we hope that the renovation will be successful and still on budget. It is always our largest question mark. When you're building a new facility, most of the things are known. The only thing that we really ran into with the new building was an old downtown building foundation that was in the ground that we were unaware of. I mean, there were several that were there that we knew about, one that we didn't know about. So that was a little additional cost, but the new facility has gone very well. As always, renovation is a different animal. You don't know exactly what you'll get until you get in there. We've already had a floor that no one knew had a slope to it, that has a slope to it that we have to resolve. And so we'll, I'm sure we'll encounter things like that, but there's a contingency in the budget in case those things happen that's already been put in place. And so our belief right now is that we will still complete the project within budget.
In the past, the county has had to send inmates elsewhere at a cost because there weren't enough beds. Now, with nearly twice as many, will the county entertain accepting inmates from other counties that may have a space issue?
It's not our main priority. First of all, we may have to house out for short periods of time during the transition when we're moving from one side to the other, so I don't want to say we won't ever house out again. We will have additional capacity, obviously, but our first and major goal is to ensure that we've got appropriate housing for the detainees that we house from McLean County. And I think any conversations about utilization of others, conversations about utilization of facility for detainees from other sites, beyond what we normally do, and there, you know, we do exchange individual detainees with some of our neighboring counties, depending upon special circumstances, and that's a regular occurrence, but it's not a large number of individuals, but. I think any other conversations about housing additional inmates would be a long ways down the road.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with McLean County Administrator Bill Wasson. New county budget adopted, and it appears to be perhaps less, maybe austere than it had been the last couple of years because growth had diminished greatly in the county. Do you see the county perhaps having turned the corner on that and growth in the future, or is that too hard to project at this point?
I think the big benefit today was, and through this fiscal year, was that the state budget was not quite as adverse to the county as we projected a year ago. As many of us can recall, the budget came late and for a couple of years, and ultimately our ability to determine exactly how the budget was going to function in 2018 and what revenues were going to come from the state of Illinois was extremely difficult with the short period of time we had. So we were conservative, and we took necessary steps, which included some significant reductions in force, over 40 positions, I believe. And so the good news was that the state budget impact was not quite as adverse, and we were able to, as Finance Chairman Salzer noted today, we were able to right-size a little bit. And then we've been able to identify some outside funding opportunities through grants to help us to increase positions. And we are also working to both increase census and necessary staffing at the nursing home through our efforts with the AOCs for both of the hospitals in town. We are in place with OSF and in discussions with Advocate Aurora. And so we continue those works, which have led to some restoration, really not restoration of positions, but right-sizing and some increasing, some additions to positions that are necessary to meet the grants and to meet our goals at the nursing home.
How many additional positions might you be adding countywide?
I think the total FTE count, I believe, was 16. Broadly, over those, the vast majority priority over those categories I just discussed.
That's still probably a little less than what you had maybe 2 years ago from what you recall?
Yeah, that's less than half of what we cut a year ago. So, again, a little bit of right-sizing and some hard work on behalf of county agency staff to identify grant opportunities where we can generate outside revenue to provide additional services to the community, and secondly, to assist with our work with the hospitals in bringing Medicare rehabilitation patients to the nursing home.
And the budget passed the 34th of your time with McLean County, and the last budget that you'll be part of, apparently, announcing your retirement effective next June. And as you said, a bittersweet moment for you.
Yeah, it's having worked for this organization for that long, I think it's today, I don't think most individuals think about or anticipate that they're going to work for the same organization for their entire careers. When I joined the workforce, it wasn't quite as unusual for somebody to do that. I will tell you, from my position, it speaks to the quality of the McLean County organization and my work with all the county board chairmen and chairpersons along the way, from Nancy Froelich to Gary Riss to Mike Sweeney to Matt Sorensen to Chairman McIntyre currently, and then my work with Bam Peterson, with John Zunick and Terry Lindbergh, as well as everybody else that works hard every day and is what we like to say are true believers that work for McLean County. They may not
true all, believers in what?
Yeah, they may not all believe in the same thing, but they are true believers in what they do. Our health department staff feels very strongly that what they do is important to the community and safeguards the community. Our public safety employees believe that what they do is extremely important, and that's why they're there. And I think, whether it's our Parks and Recreation Department providing resource management and recreational opportunities, or the Highway Department keeping the roads plowed and open and in good shape for our constituents, we are an organization of true believers, and true believers that what we do is important, and true believers that we are all a community and working together.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with McLean County Administrator Bill Wasson. Now, you leave at a time. Now, I understand you're going to be staying on through next June to help with the transition, but there are 6 new county board members coming on board. Almost a third of the board is turning over. So this is a pretty significant time where a lot of institutional knowledge is going out the window. How do you help in that transition to assure that what's been established continues while at the same time new ideas are brought to the table?
Yeah, I think, and we've seen these types of transitions before. I think it is cyclical. It's not unexpected that we're gonna see changes and turnover. I believe very strongly that the individuals who run for county board do so because they care about the community, because they want to help, county board members, especially in McLean County, have always worried first and foremost about the community and what's best for the community. And I think I have no misgivings or questions in my mind that's going to change.
What advice for the person that fills this chair come next June? What pitfalls might they encounter? How do you best prepare them to continue on in following your legacy?
Well, I think it's a it's an office and an organization that gives you a vast opportunity to work on a wide variety of different issues. The issues change daily in our office. We talk to people when they join our office about the need to actually revel in the fact that things do change every day of the week. It is the kind of environment where you really want to learn something new. I've been with the organization 34 years, and every day I learn something new. I learned something new about McLean County. I learned something new about local government. And so, you know, my advice is that we have always had a very good county board who has been willing to set policy and direction and then allow staff to implement those policies. And my expectation is this will always be a very good organization to come and work for. And anybody who's looking for an opportunity in public service and working on issues that are important to the community should consider working for McLean County.
That was McLean County Administrator Bill Wasson with GLT's Eric Stock. Wasson served as the county's Parks and Recreation Director for 22 years. Before moving to the County Administrator's Office, he has held the top job there for 8 years. The County Board will swear in 6 new members on December 3rd.
Support for GLT comes from Pontiac's Vermilion Players and the Eagle Theater, presenting It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play, November 30th through December 2nd and December 6th through the 9th, a dinner theater production of the holiday classic. Details at PontiacEagle.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Laura Kennedy's report on a new approach to the holiday show at the McLean County Arts Center. If you go for real over fake, this edition of GLT's Gardening Podcast on Christmas trees is for you. ISU's Patrick Murphy shares his tips with GLT's Mike McCurdy on selecting and caring for a real tree, even one that might get planted later.
Winter is in the air, Thanksgiving is nearly here, and for some that means it'll be time to trim the Christmas tree. Traditionalists will buy a real one, maybe cutting it down or opting for a live tree to plant later. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. How are you, Murph?
Doing well. How are you, Mike?
I'm doing well. So when it comes time to get a real tree, we can get them at the garden center, a big box store, even grocery stores have trees. What kind of trees, species are we looking at when browsing those kinds of trees in those stores?
I think that the fir trees are the best trees. You get your balsam firs, you get your Fraser firs, noble firs. It's not that they're the only ones, they're just a personal favorite. They have the soft needle, they have the great fragrance, and they come in lots of shapes and sizes, so they kind of fit into decor a little bit better than your traditional Scotch pines and white pines and your short-needled spruce.
And is that what we used to see at those stores or in homes, were those kinds of trees? Are you saying our tastes have changed?
They have changed, and what is old is no longer desirable. So what is new and fashionable is more desirable. So the years ago when I was in high school, my father helped me get Christmas tree lot jobs all the time, and the primary trees were Scotch pine, Ponderosa pine. That they've become almost invisible as a Christmas tree, not available because they're popular as a live tree to plant. But the firs and stuff came along, and they're cleaner typically, and they have that kind of chameleon type essence that you don't get from some of the pines that are also a little on the messy side.
Sure. So what do you like, and what do you do for Christmas when it comes to a tree?
Well, we rarely have a single tree. We usually have multiple trees, and we'll have a live tree And my wife, who's very artistic and handy at the same time, she's made a tree out of beach glass that we've collected from our time off the years, and we're really proud of that. And but we still kind of like the Charlie Brown Christmas trees, you know, and I think that the Charlie Brown Christmas trees are a kind of metaphor of all things have beauty and makes it easy to hang ornaments also.
When you don't have it, when it's not really dense, you can get in there and hang the ornament on the, on a branch.
Yeah, and I think some of the best presentations I've seen are the ones where the ornaments lay within the tree and they're not just covering the outside of it. I find that to be appealing.
Of course, at one point, the tree and a Charlie Brown Christmas actually drooped all the way over because of the weight of the ornaments. We don't want that.
That's not practical. That's right.
So how do we select a good tree regardless of the species? I'm talking about sort of rules that apply to any tree.
Well, I think the first thing that's important is the proper size. And then once you've kind of narrowed down the logistics on your Christmas tree selection, you can test to see how fresh it is by making sure the needles are firmly attached. So you want to give them a good tug, and they should not break free easily. And you want to make sure that you're not grabbing one that is hiding lots of broken branches because it has been wrapped, perhaps, for travel. And you also want to make sure that it's not up all bruised up. So what I mean by that is in the trunk areas and the bottom sides of the branches, which are exposed during bundling, you want to make sure they're nice and clean and just that the tree's not all banged up.
So you mentioned traveling and bundling. Where are these trees coming from that we buy in Central Illinois?
Well, from my experience only, first, I can say most of them come from Wisconsin and Michigan. But I know that they come from the Dakotas. They come from all the places up north where they have the larger conifer farms. But when I lived and worked in the Chicagoland area, there were Christmas tree farms all over that area. But most of those are show up and cut your own tree type places.
So what are the steps to take once we get the pre-cut tree at home?
The best scenario is if you have a garage or a shop that would allow you to give your tree a shower in the stand. That's a best case scenario. If you can't do that, like most of us cannot, what you want to do is get it unwrapped and give it a good shaking because it's going to be full of all kinds of crumbs and grit. So put the tree in a stand, give it a good shake, and let it stand up in the stand out in the cold for a night or two before you actually bring it in the house.
Does the shaking knock insects off? I mean, at this time of year, do we have to worry about insects at all?
I don't think you have to worry about it too much. You know, you could get a stray insect in there, but I think, you know, just think about this tree's been outside, and the last place it was before it came to your house was on a flatbed truck traveling down the road. It's going to be dirty. It's going to have stuff on it. So that's the best thing you can do is just kind of give it a good shake. And those branches oftentimes will settle in a downward position after the tree's unwrapped and upright in the stand.
What about going to a Christmas tree farm and harvesting one? Anything to keep in mind there?
I think that the distance of travel is important because you could select a really nice tree. Say you live here in Central Illinois and you travel all the way to Morris or Ottawa. Well, you might have a little challenge getting that tree home without a new layer of ice and snow and whatever road residues on it. Plus, I'm a big fan of supporting the local farmers. You know, we do that when we dine out nowadays. And you might have to travel quite a ways to get a tree from a fresh-cut farm. So take the proper wrapping and bundling, because unless you have a pickup truck with a topper or a van, it's probably going to be strapped to the top of your car in a Christmas vacation postcard moment.
If someone's actually considering a live tree, what are some things they might want to take into consideration, some things they want to take care of pretty quickly?
Got to dig the hole first and put the soil somewhere where it won't freeze, because what's going to happen after Christmas or a day or two after Christmas, it's going to be time to take that tree and its soil ball full of roots outside and plant it. So you have to kind of take some precautions like cover the hole to make sure that no one falls into it. And then you have soil that's workable and pliable. It's a project. It requires some dedication, no doubt about that.
And winter came on quickly in Central Illinois. We have unseasonably cold temperatures. We also have some unseasonable snow. This would make everything a little more difficult to actually plant that tree, unless we get a warm spell here.
That's right. And, you know, the snow can go away quickly. But if you have the wheelbarrow or a couple of tubs full of the loose soil in your garage, it might be a little bit messy, but it's still doable.
So these trees are balled and burlapped?
They would have the wire cage, and then between the soil and the wire cage is some kind of burlap. I would wrap that whole ball in like a plastic bag or something so there's no wicking or dripping or any water weeping out of it, because it might thaw out in your house a little bit.
Sure, and to keep it moist.
So and to help keep it moist.
So you have to take that into account when you're talking about the total height.
That's right. So, that's right.
And again, nothing in particular we need to worry about as it concerns bringing a live tree in the house as opposed to one that's essentially dead that's been cut down?
Most of the guidelines that I have encountered give you about a one-week time frame. 1 week from bringing it home, putting it in the house, celebrating Christmas, and getting it out of the house and back into the ground. And again, I think that's something that requires some dedication, but it's worth doing. If you found a very exotic conifer that you've desired for your landscape, this is a good way to kind of be frugal and also advance your landscaping plans.
This is not an American tradition, but Christmas trees have been part of a Christmas celebration in North America for 240 years. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
My understanding is that the church, as it's referred to by Christians, adopted this from the pagans, and they did it to try and encourage them to become part of their flock. But nonetheless, the evergreen presence of the Christmas tree is one that is a sign of everlasting life, and that's kind of equates towards the European Christian narrative.
And it was brought over to this country by Germans and other Europeans that settled North
America.
My
understanding too, Mike, yeah.
If you have questions about Christmas trees, live or otherwise, you can submit them at WGLT.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about attracting and taking care of wildlife during the winter months. Anything that you're looking to actually attract to your yard, Patrick?
I just like the cardinals and the little warbler-type birds. It's just fun to watch. It's colorful.
That's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org/grow.
Subscribe to the Grow Podcast and find past episodes at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, striving to be the destination of choice for cancer services in the eastern region of central Illinois through effective partnerships coupled with personalized care. Information at cancercenter.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington is trying something new this year with their annual holiday show. Artists are venturing out of their studios to share creative energy and connect with the public. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
You can always find work from local artists within the sales gallery at the McLean County Arts Center, and now you can find the artists themselves. The Artisan Workshop Residence runs as part of the Holiday Treasures exhibition and sale now through December 15th. Each week, a new artist will set up residency and put their creative process front and center. On this sunny November day, Natalie Wetzel, an encaustic and mixed-media painter, encourages visitors to join her in creating.
They're just using hot utensils like an iron to melt colored wax on paper, and it's called encaustics. Just playing around, making marks, seeing how the medium interacts on paper and when you layer it.
You want to try the big one, too?
Yeah.
Because different sizes. We've got a little stylus that makes a tiny little mark. You can do a thin line or small dots. And then we've got a medium size.
So basically, you're here not merely creating art yourself, but helping others create art?
It's just fun for people to play around with it, and a lot of people aren't familiar with it. So as I've been working on this piece here, but they came in, and I thought it might be fun for them to have a shot at, you know, trying it out. So not a lot of people work in it, so there's not a huge familiarity. You can do more drawing if you use the stylus, and this is more I use for like backdrops, large areas. I'm very impatient, so it's a great medium for that because as soon as it hits the surface, it dries. But it's tricky because you risk losing something you love to fix something you don't like, because as soon as the hot, you know, iron hits it, it'll melt again and it transforms the surface all over. So it's kind of a push and pull back and forth war with paint.
Doug Johnson is the director of the McLean County Arts Center, and he says this is the first year for the Artisan Workshop, which he believes is a great way for artists to showcase their work and engage with the community. Natalie Wetzel says she embraced the offer to take part in what she calls a unique opportunity.
And I had kind of stepped back from making art for about a year and went through some transition in my life and just felt like it was kind of the kick I needed to get busy painting again, and it's been really great.
So how did you go about selecting the artists that you wanted to have here? Were you looking for a certain array of different types and styles of artwork?
Yeah, we certainly were, and the benefit of that is you know, we had Kara Kirshner, who was a felting artist who does sculpture. We've had just different artists from around the spectrum, and that's been really nice to have folks that are doing something unusual and different, especially somebody who's, if they aren't familiar, if they haven't seen someone do encaustics before, if they haven't seen someone do felting before. And so it's a showcase. We're happy about that.
Tell me about how people are reacting so far.
Well, just like you're seeing now, we've had steady crowds that have come in. The artists have been able to respond to people in the community that either just happen in because they're shopping or come in particularly to see those artists. And so it's been a great exchange of ideas.
Natalie, what's it feel like? I mean, most artists, you know, they'll work in their studios. What does it mean to you to be working and creating in an environment that has, you basically have an audience?
Yeah, it's, what first was a little intimidating, but if I get them involved, then, you know, I'm not in it alone. But,
does that make you feel a little bit more comfortable if you're not making art by yourself?
Yeah, I had a little taste of working in front of people when I owned the Pod Normal. And, you know, a lot of times if it were slow that day, I would start painting or whatever, and people would come in. And at first I was really intimidated by it, and then I got to a point where seeing their joy in the interaction, and it made them more connected, I think, to what I was doing. And it was just a human experience that was positive.
Do you think that people coming in and watching you create art and even joining in if they like, do you think that that will be more apt to prompt them to maybe get involved in creating art themselves than if they just go and see stuff hanging on a wall by themselves?
Oh, absolutely. And there is, you know, I hear all the time, I'm not an artist, I can't do that, you know, and there is an artfulness in every single person. And we all have it, whether we want to admit it or not. And sometimes it's just taken away the fear of trying, you know. And anyway, it's great to be able to just engage and share, you know, that with. And you learn from other people, too. And I mean, I'm even looking at their work and seeing strokes I haven't made with, you know, the same utensils. So you can hopefully grow as an artist that way, too. So,
well, you know, I think the great thing about art making is that we're able to not just look at work and not just appreciate the works of others, but that art is an activity. And to make artwork is an active stance. And I think the more that we allow ourselves to explore and challenge and learn and fail and experiment, the more we can learn about ourselves. And that's a great thing about these activities.
Did you make specific plans for the week of what you're going to be doing each day? How did you plan out your residency?
No.
It's just improvisation,
yeah,
all the way?
Everything in my life's like that, unfortunately. No, I wing it. You know, it's to me, the joy of making art, you know, some people labor and labor over pieces, and with good reason, it's hard to let go of them. But I work quick and intuitively, and for me, the joy is in the actual process. And so once it's finished, I move on to other pieces. You know, I'm not as attached to the final piece as I am the process. So any artist will tell you, you hit strides. I'd stepped back from painting for a year, and it was very painful. I did not enjoy the process when I went, you know, started to make work again. And it's not like riding a bike. You have to kind of relearn everything. And it's not good to take a ton of time off, you know, from your craft. And mentally and emotionally, you can come back with kind of a fire that you know had maybe diminished a little bit. Sometimes you get to a point where things become more effortless, and you kind of lose yourself in it, and that's your happy place, or my happy place, you know, when you get to that point.
It's a lot like being an athlete. You know, the athletes really have to gear themselves up for the competition season or for the Olympics, and artists are really the same way. You have to get to the point that, let's say, you have an exhibition coming up, and you have to get to the point that is a daily part of your schedule and your mindset, but it's something that you cycle through. And it's certainly, you can't do that all the time. Our spouses wouldn't allow it all the time. But it's certainly part of the process. And so the fact that, you know, Natalie's taken some time off, I've had periods where I've taken time off, becomes the challenge. And, you know, to have a showcase where people can come in and see Natalie as she's jumping back in with both feet, I think that's a wonder. And we're very excited to be a showcase for that.
That's Doug Johnson and Natalie Wetzel. The artist's residency will continue at the McLean County Arts Center in Bloomington through December 15th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos of Natalie Wetzel at work at our website, WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The history of surgery is a grisly one. Lindsay Fitzharris graduated from Emory Wesleyan University in 2004 and has since become a prize-winning medical historian. She is the author of The Butchering Art, Joseph Lister's Quest to Transform the Grisly World of Victorian Medicine. Fitzharris recently gave a talk at IWU titled That Good Old Hospital Stink about Lister and his belief surgery could be made much safer with cleanliness and antiseptics. Fitzharris says it starts with the fact Lister was a Quaker.
His religion played a huge role in it, and I feel like he was very much a man pushed towards his fate. One of the things is Quakerism. He didn't believe that he should charge his patients, that they should decide how much to pay him, which really kind of ticked off some of his colleagues. And he was probably in general more kind than other surgeons at the time. He tended to bond with his patients in a way that you don't really see other surgeons bonding with them. And I think that did have to do with his Quaker upbringing. So he remains the Quaker and sort of an outsider in this sort of hedonistic medical community that he steps into.
How hedonistic and why? Why was it that way?
I always say it's kind of like Gangs of New York meets Sherlock. It's like, you know, in Gangs of New York, they were wearing those huge stovepipe hats, like really tall ones. They were dressed kind of gaudily. This was a time when all kinds of drugs were being discovered. So you have opiates and you have cocaine. And in fact, there's these caricatures of doctors holding these canes, because they would have these canes that they would walk around with. And on the top, they would keep their drugs. And so there's a lot of caricatures of sort of them sniffing the tops of these canes. And so when ether, for instance, ether is discovered in 1846, people start drinking it, they start inhaling it, they start doing all kinds of, having ether parties. And so nothing's regulated in the medical community. So he really kind of steps into that hedonistic world where there's no regulations. We see this sort of in the Nick, the Showtime show, a TV series with Clive Owen, where he plays this drug-addicted doctor at the turn of the century. And that really was the world that Lister sort of stepped into.
Or we can go back to Cider House Rules, too, with Michael Caine inadvertently killing himself with ether.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And people did. They overdose. Also, ether is really flammable, so, and everybody was smoking pipes. And so you definitely get a lot of accidents in these operating theaters, people kind of realizing these drugs are very dangerous in certain kinds of ways. When electricity is introduced into hospitals, that brings certain kinds of dangers. So we don't think about those things. And that was really the world that Lister was navigating. And I like to say that The Butchering Art is the prequel to the popular TV series The Nick, because it takes us 50 years earlier when there is no anesthesia, when there is no antisepsis, there is no concept of germs, and it's incredibly dangerous. And these surgeons, they never wash their hands or their instruments, because if you don't understand germs, why would you wash them in between patients? They're just going to get dirty with the next patient. And they would wear these aprons that were just crusted with blood. And the more blood, the better, because that meant that you had done a lot of operations, you had a lot of experience. And they carried this smell that they called good old hospital stink. And it was a thing of pride, you know. It was a disgusting time, but people didn't really understand, of course, that this was adding to mortality rates.
How much did it add?
This is always a difficult question, because hospital statistics are in their infancy, so records aren't kept to the extent they are today. It was said that certain amputations could carry with it as high as a 50 to 60% mortality rate. So of course, you only chop that leg off if you absolutely had to, and if you took the leg off, you still could die of postoperative infection because everything was filthy. And your chances probably decreased, you know, if you were the last patient on that table because the table wasn't washed down and nothing was clean at that point. So speed was incredibly important. You have surgeons that, you know, would walk into the operating theater and say, "Time me, gentlemen." And people would pull out their pocket watches and they would time, you know, these surgeons. And they could, some good surgeons could hold you down and take your leg off in under 30 seconds, which is pretty incredible because not only did they take the leg off, but all the arteries and everything has to be tied off. It's really bloody. So that is impressive, I have to say. Even though I wouldn't have personally wanted to go through something like that, I would want my surgeon to be very fast if I had to.
So how did he get to the idea of germ theory?
So he, number one, he's well-placed. So this goes back to his Quakerism. He isn't allowed to do forms of entertainment like dancing. He's not allowed to partake in musical entertainment, but science is encouraged in the Quaker communities. And so his father has this microscope, and he introduces Lister to it when he's a small boy. And so he brings this microscope to university with him. So he's sort of well-placed to understand this world of the infinitely small. And he sees people are dying. He doesn't know why, like any surgeon. He's trying to put this together, and he reads a paper by Louis Pasteur. And Pasteur says, Pasteur's trying to solve this reason why wine vats are spoiling, because we don't want the wine to spoil. It's very, very
tragic.
Very tragic, yeah. And he says that, you know, the smell of spoiled wine, and Lister's thinking, well, wounds smell when they start to sour, they would call it, when they start to fester. And I wonder if what's causing the wine to spoil might also be causing the wounds to spoil. And so he begins to experiment with the carbolic acid, which is an antiseptic, and he begins seeing results. So I always say that the butchering art is a love story between science and medicine because it is the first time that a scientific principle is applied to medical practice. And Lister gets a lot of pushback because here's this young guy and he's telling you that there are these invisible little creatures and they're killing your patients. Believe me, I have this really strange instrument called a microscope and I can see them. And he was also telling these doctors that they had been inadvertently killing their patients all along. And I think that was a hard pill to swallow.
No doctor wants to deliberately cause harm. That goes back to the Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah. And, you know, I tell a lot of entertaining stories about some of these surgeons, the fastest knife in the West End. And as funny as it can be to us, you know, 150 years on, going into medicine was very dangerous. It's before mass vaccinations, it's before antibiotics. So the mortality rates amongst doctors was quite high. An example would be Charles Darwin's uncle by the same name, so his name was Charles Darwin, was in medical school in Edinburgh, and he was dissecting a child and he cut his hand and he got a bacterial infection and he was dead within 72 hours. And they called them pinprick cuts because of course gloves weren't worn, you know, no protective gear. So going into medicine could be very dangerous. It was certainly a decision you made in seriousness. I mean, still, hopefully today people are still taking that as a serious decision, but of course your life was on the line as well.
That could also encourage the hedonism, you know, if you have such an uncertain life expectancy and it is a dangerous profession, then you might tend to really live it up while you could.
Yeah, I think that's probably absolutely true. You know, smallpox has been eradicated. That was around. Lister contracts smallpox while in medical school. He has a mental breakdown and leaves medical school at one point. So it was dangerous to be in London full stop, which could be a real pest house. And it was dangerous, of course, to be in these hospitals. Being a surgeon was really sort of like being a craftsman at the time. It was a person who worked with their hands for their living. And so it was seen as below a physician, certainly. So if you were wealthy or middle class, you really didn't want your son to go to be a surgeon.
How does Lister's life and his story still resonate today in medicine? And what should we be paying attention to in today's society from his example?
I think the big take home I want from the butchering art is that people should know that what we know today isn't what we're going to know tomorrow, and that we need to be open to new ideas because, of course, when Lister comes along, nobody believes him. It takes many years. And the way that he ultimately triumphs is he looks to the younger generation and he convinces them, and they become the Listerians, and they go out into the world and spread the gospel of Lister. And I think that there are so many things. What is the next paradigm that's going to be shattered? What is it that we're going to say, oh my gosh, I can't believe We never knew that. And maybe it has something to do with antibiotic resistance or gene therapy, but there's going to be something. And science and medicine is always shifting. The way we understand the world is always shifting. I think Lister is a hero for our day because at a time when science is constantly under attack, it's becoming a global contagion, here is this man who stood behind his data, he stood behind his science, and as a result, he was able to change the world.
Medical historian Lindsay Fitzharris is currently pitching a movie about Joseph Lister to Hollywood studios. Her next book will be about David Gillies, the founder of modern plastic surgery. In February, she won the Pen America Award for literary science writing. She also hosts Under the Knife, a channel on YouTube. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A statewide group is calling for a criminal investigation of the Western Illinois University Board of Trustees, University President Jack Thomas, and other officers of the institution. IPR's Rich Egger has more.
The University Professionals of Illinois represents faculty, academic staff, and other employees at seven public universities, including Western. Its statewide president is John Miller. He says the group filed its complaint with the McDonough County State's Attorney's Office. Miller says UPI is concerned about the recently released recording of the June 28th closed-door meeting of Western's board. The Illinois Attorney General's Office ordered the audio be made public after ruling board members and administrators violated the Illinois Open Meetings Act. Miller says based on that recording, UPI is concerned similar violations occurred during the board's other closed-door meetings.
The whole underlying thought of what occurred in that meeting and what appears to be such an extreme violation of the Open Meetings Act, we just did not want to leave that set.
What do you consider to possibly be criminal about their conduct?
Almost the entire component was a violation of the Open Meetings Act. The Open Meetings Act does have it's a Class C violation, a Class C misdemeanor. And so on that front, it by default, if the state's attorney agrees that this is. But when I looked and listened to it, I heard, so for example, you hear the beginning of the scripted aspect of it. Well, how did a script get written and a decision get written about the script? Which means it had to have occurred prior. Mm-hmm. How did that occur? Then, so you have that, which is undermining the act. That's extreme. Then you have references to future discussions, that we're going to continue these policy discussions in future meetings. There is the 2+2 meetings that were being referenced in this that makes you wonder, is there an attempt here to circumvent? And so the combination of all of that is where we decided that, you know, we're going to need to file, rather than just filing, continue to file Open Meeting Act violations and requesting the transcripts, we wanted some legal authority to take a look at this and decide whether or not this needs. So hence a state's attorney in McDonough County would have primary jurisdiction, and the state's the attorney general, Lisa Madigan's office right now, has concurrent. So we decided to file.
You refer to 2+2 meetings or 2+2 meetings.
2+2 meetings.
What are those?
We're not exactly sure what they are, and that's why we're asking for an investigation of those. Two trustees were talking about meeting and talking about the budget in a spreadsheet that they had. And then another trustee referenced, oh, yeah, those are part of, well, if you have a 2+2, which seems to be suggesting that there's this policy or this attempt to have these meetings that where two trustees are meeting with an administrator or meeting together to discuss university policy in a way that seems to circumvent what the Open Meetings Act is. If a majority of the required quorum is present, then it has to be a meeting of boards. And so this seems to be a way to move around that where they can meet with two together to discuss policy and share that around. So we're asking the state's attorney to take a look at that to see if that is indeed an intent to circumvent the Open Meetings Act.
Well, that is technically legal to do that, right?
It could be unless there's an intention to circumvent it, in which case then that raises where potentially, I guess, the legal question comes. And that's why we're deferring to the state's attorney. And if the state's attorney needs to defer to the Attorney General's office on that.
So UPI is calling for a criminal investigation. Have you actually filed a suit, or how does this
work?
So
we have notified the state's attorney here. We filed our letter to the attorney general or to the state's attorney asking him to do the criminal investigation that's permitted underneath the act. And at the same time, we, of course, CC'd that to the attorney general's office in Springfield.
How soon do you expect some sort of resolution?
I don't know. This is a complex concept. There are, if you look at it, given the references to future meetings that were held in there and the references to potentially past meetings, the fact that the institution has not released minutes for the last 21 closed meetings that they had, which raises the question, if this is what we hear in this, are there other components to it? That's one of the reasons why we're asking the state's attorney to get the audio recordings of all those other closed sessions so that the legal authority can listen to see if there's other violations that are occurring or if this is the norm of this board. We don't know any of that. I have no idea how long that process is going to take.
What are potential penalties? Are there any? Is it just a slap on the wrist, or
No? They're underneath the act is a Class C misdemeanor. While the act doesn't list specifically what the penalty is, on another reference sheet that's available by the Attorney General's on the OMA Act, it references that it could be punishable. A Class C misdemeanor could be punishable up to 30 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. We're not. Our concern isn't that. Our concern is the lack of transparency so that there's no accountability. To us, that's the biggest issue, especially when we see the decisions that the institution is making that don't seem to be necessarily, in our perspective, the best interest of the institution, the community, and the region. There needs to be, or in the state and the alumni for that matter as well, that we feel that we need to have some type of transparency there to have accountability.
John Miller is statewide president of the University Professionals of Illinois, Local 4100, and he's a former teacher at Western Illinois University. UPI is asking for a criminal investigation of Western's board and administration for possible violations of the state's Open Meetings Act. Western's administration declined to comment on UPI's complaint. Rich Egger reporting.
In 1959, the all-white North Shore suburb of Deerfield condemned a housing development that was in the process of being built after village officials discovered that the developers intended to sell the homes to African Americans. The situation led Amy Roost's parents to give up a baby girl they had adopted. The girl was half African American. For Illinois Issues, Roost talks more about that, the troubled racial history of Deerfield, and the integration issues that remain today.
While visiting my hometown of Deerfield, Illinois recently, I stopped by a lunch counter for an Italian beef. I encountered 80-year-old Barry Saffin, who was debating the diner's owner on a hot-button topic in Deerfield these days, affordable housing.
Are you making a living that you can afford housing somewhere close enough by? You have a car you drive here,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You're supporting a family?
Yeah.
Many people don't have that. They work here, but they can't afford it. You say, they don't want it in your backyard. Well, if not yours, whose?
In his younger days, Barry would not have been welcome in Deerfield because he's Jewish. Today, Deerfield, a village of 18,000 mostly white residents, is home to a large Jewish community. However, it still struggles to roll out the welcome wagon. Case in point, a proposed workforce housing development known as Zion Woods that many Deerfieldians oppose.
I think most people's concern is about property value, and I get that that's a selfish thing, but it's a reality that many people have to face.
That was a Deerfield resident for whom Zion Woods is literally her backyard. She asked I not use her name because she didn't want her neighbors to, as she put it, come after her. The state requires 10% of all housing be designated for low-income individuals. However, because of its home rule status, Deerfield is exempt from this regulation. Mayor of Deerfield Harriet Rosenthal explains.
Well, the state gave home rule communities the ability not to provide the 10% workforce housing that the state was requiring. So statutorily, we don't have to do that. Ethically, morally, we are trying to provide more.
I asked other Deerfield residents what they think of Zion Woods and why they think Deerfield is still so segregated. Most people I spoke to were unaware of a local controversy that made national headlines in 1959, a housing incident that in many ways echoes the Zion Woods debate. Deerfield librarian Dylan Zabagno explains.
Developer Morris Milgram purchased land to develop as suburban housing, but with a difference, his developments would be integrated. When Deerfield residents learned that the housing development was going to be integrated, many immediately opposed it. This was an all-white community. A lot of people opposed it because they opposed integration altogether.
Longtime Deerfield resident Art Shea described what he witnessed in an interview I conducted with him prior to his recent passing.
Well, one Sunday morning, a guy lived two, three houses up here, came around with his five children dressed for church. He was a co-pilot in my war, and he had one of his kids carrying a petition. Said, do you, don't you want niggers to live on this street? And I said, what did we fight the war for, you know?
Early next year, the Deerfield Library will host a series of guest speakers, including, full disclosure, myself and Angel Smith, a child adopted by my parents in 1962 and then relinquished because her skin proved too dark for Deerfield.
Amy Bruce reported for Illinois Issues. We're hearing more on the news lately about cases of rape or sexual assault. The increased awareness and very different public responses are focusing attention on many of the ways the system often fails victims. Illinois Newsroom's Steph Whiteside reports on what some in Illinois are doing to bring greater support to survivors.
Sexual violence is an issue that touches the lives of millions of Americans.
Close to one in four women and one in nine men are victims of some form of sexual violence, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner.
Megan Thomas works for the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. Even with greater awareness, advocates say we are still struggling to understand how rape and sexual assault affect victims and how the process of seeking justice can add to the trauma. Thomas notes that the number of survivors is just an estimate, because most victims of sexual violence don't report. Polly Poskin is executive director of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. She says that has a lot to do with culture and an unwillingness to believe victims.
Why would you tell somebody, or why would you open your mouth about something that happened to you that you have learned just kind of by being alive that nobody's going to believe me?
One big issue is a lack of understanding about the various responses to trauma.
In the moment of that sexual assault, we go into our survival instincts.
Diana Dickey is a therapist specializing in trauma.
When our bodies and our brains are triggered to go into that survival, we either go into fight, flight, or freeze.
Most people are familiar with the fight or flight concept, but freezing is a response people are less familiar with. Freeze, Diana says, happens when fight or flight isn't an option.
It's almost like it's our brain's last line of defense, where we may not be able to protect our bodies, but we can protect our brain.
The person experiencing trauma may dissociate or check out in an effort to protect their mind from what is happening to their body. Without a clear understanding of trauma, Poskin emphasizes the importance of first responders not passing judgment before an investigation.
Don't be making preliminary decisions about whether this is a bona fide case or a believable case or a credible case until you look at that evidence.
Another issue is the investigation itself. In addition to questioning by law enforcement, a victim may also elect to have a rape kit taken to gather evidence. This exam can take 4 hours or more. It's excruciatingly detailed, swabbing and combing and probing the victim's body, which has now become a crime scene. The invasiveness can add more trauma for the victim. Nurses can undergo specialized training to perform these exams, but not all hospitals have those experts on staff. ICASA has been working to change that.
By the year 2022, we'll have a qualified medical personnel in the emergency departments to respond to rape victims. And for us, that means sexual assault nurse examiners.
A trained nurse can speed up the time spent performing the exam, making it less traumatizing for the patient. There's another reason this training is so essential. It's about correctly collecting evidence in a way that will hold up in court.
The reason to do evidence collection properly, the reason to swab for the DNA is to make sure you have the individual who perpetrated the crime, not somebody who didn't.
Illinois has been working on laws to make reporting and prosecution more effective and less traumatizing. One is a law requiring police to file a report any time a sexual assault is reported, regardless of jurisdiction or how long ago the assault took place. Police and other first responders are also required to undergo training on how to interact with sexual assault victims. This law took effect in 2017.
There's standardized required training. Some of it's in person, some of it's online.
Illinois was one of the first states to pass a law requiring an audit of backlogged rape kits, and as of today, all backlogged kits that were part of an ongoing investigation have been processed. What it really comes down to, says Poskin, is priorities.
We decided we want smoking to stop. It is impressive, the amount of people power, brain power, money power that gets poured into campaigns and work. And that's just a matter of resources. That's a matter of prioritizing.
I'm Steph Whiteside, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media collaboration focused on education, politics, health, and the environment. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Laura Kennedy, Mike McCurdy, and Eric Stock. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.